This is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. Tonight we are talking with Dr. Greg Corbin. Now, this is going to be a very interesting story. Greg has written a book called Beyond Reason, Lessons from the Loss of a Gifted Child. And we're going to hear about a very beautiful yet very extraordinarily touching story of, well, I'm going to let you tell us. Basically, you know, this is your story. It's profoundly personal. Why don't you tell us how the story begins?
Sure, Lori. Yeah, thanks for having me on. So Brian was my 9-year-old son, and he died about 17 years ago, and it took me that long to be able to write the book and tell his story. And he was a really sweet, very gifted child. He was smarter than I was, and he was very talented. He wrote nice poetry and a lot of things that I couldn't do. And he was always coming up with something. I mean, he was always telling stories and pulling tricks on people from the time he was really little. One example was when he was 4, my wife, Catherine, took him to the local store where she went in shopping. And she went in for a few minutes. He stayed outside, and there was a group of teenage boys out there. And Brian went over and was talking to them, and Catherine came out a minute or two later, and one of the teenage boys came over very somberly up to her and said, "Well, I'm very sorry to hear about his cousin Kim." And Catherine said, "His cousin Kim?" And the boy said, "Yes, the one who fell off the dock in Alaska and drowned." And Catherine looked at the boy and said, "Well, I'm sorry, he's been telling you a story. He doesn't really have a cousin Kim." So he was always doing stuff like that. There was always something exciting when Brian was around. Mm-hmm. And he was full of joy. I had trouble fitting in. Didn't really like school too much, and didn't like Sunday school and things like that. And then right before his 9th birthday, which was in January, Brian told us a couple weeks before that he didn't want to have a party because it would bring his death closer. Mm. And he said he would never live to see double digits, which was age 10. So, and he started getting very depressed, had trouble sleeping, and was kind of obsessed with the idea of death. And he was kind of no longer a joy. He was, like, just struggling immensely. And my wife, who's a minister and pastoral counselor, would talk to him at night, you know, try and calm him down and tuck him in so he could go to sleep. But he had a lot of trouble sleeping. And he was talking about death all the time and everything. And we didn't know what was going on. We couldn't figure out what was going on because there was no reason. We tried to reassure him. There was no medical reason for him to worry about dying. But it turns out he knew more than we did. Mm. And then we took him to see a therapist. Because we just kind of ran out of things to try. And Brian loved going to the therapist. They really developed a great friendship together. But we never discovered any issues to deal with. And then over the next several months, he started coming out of his depression a little bit. And then a couple weeks before he did die, about 3 weeks before, he started becoming very joyful again. And he said it was time for him to go on his time for him to have his party. But he wanted it to be a happy spring party, not a birthday party. And he just didn't want any presents. And he just wanted 3 of his friends. So we set up the party, and it turns out it was on the morning he died. Mm. So it was really a going-away party. But we didn't know it at the time, of course. A couple days before the party, and there were a lot of other things that Brian was doing to prepare himself that we didn't realize until afterwards, that he was tying up all of his loose ends, all the things that he said, you know, he'd been meaning to do, like write his grandparents. And he got Catherine's, he died the day before Mother's Day. Mm-hmm. And he insisted that we get Catherine's Mother's Day present, you know, a week in advance, which I did. And then, but he insisted to Catherine that he get my Father's Day present, even though that was a month away. Mm-hmm. A lot of things that he had never, that were atypical. He'd never done anything like that before. And then 2 days before he died, Catherine was driving home. We live out in the country. and she was driving down our driveway, and she saw that Brian was on the side of the driveway with his little wagon with his teddy bears and his camping gear. So she stopped the car and said, "Where are you going?" And he said, "Well, it's time for me to go on my trip." And she said, "Well, you can't go on your trip. We have your party in 2 days." He said, "You have to wait for that." And so she got out of the car and sat on the ground and put Brian in her lap, and they kind of talked for a little while. And then Catherine suggested, "Well, why don't we, instead of going on your trip right now, we'll plan you can pitch your tent and tomorrow night, and that'll be your trip. We'll pitch it in the yard." And he'd always been afraid. He tried that a couple times in the past, but he'd always been afraid of the dark, and came in before the night was over. So he thought that was a great idea. So we were doing, and there was other stuff going on too. Like about the time that Brian announced it was time for his party, we had our picture of him that we had framed, and that began to fade. And there were lots of other things going on that we didn't realize at the time. So there was a lot of things kind of converging on this one moment, of which they were way beyond my understanding. I had no conception that something like this could happen. And then, the morning he did die, it was the most beautiful spring day you ever saw. And it was unseasonably warm. And the air was full of honeysuckle, which was unusual for that time of year. And he had his party, and the kids came over. They had a great time. And then the parents picked him up a few hours later. And then Brian went down to his room to finish up some things before his baseball game. Now, he died playing Little League baseball, and he was a little kid on the team, and this was only his second game. And I had always encouraged him to play because he was such a cerebral little kid. And he was a little kid on the team. He wasn't very good at baseball. He'd always been afraid of the hard ball. But today was different. So I took him to the baseball field for his game, and on the way he told me that he wanted to score a run more than anything. The first game he'd been stranded on third base and never made it home. And we got to the baseball field, and you never saw a happier kid in your life. He was so enthusiastic, he lost all of his fear of playing baseball. He was charging the ground balls and just having the best time, begging the coach to make him the pitcher, which of course he wasn't good enough to do. But he was out there. And then first time at bat, he was so little he got walked to first base. The next boy hit a triple, and Brian tore around the bases, rounded third. The coach waved him on. He crossed home plate. He was the happiest little boy I ever saw. And we were all cheering, and he was getting high fives, went into the dugout, and then he just rolled over, and his heart stopped beating, and he died. And I tried to resuscitate him. I'm an anesthesiologist. But I just knew. I looked at him, and I just knew he wasn't coming back. I mean, I thought he's had an arrhythmia. We should be able to get him back. And the rescue squad was right across the street, and they were there in 2 minutes. So rationally, but I mean, I just looked at him, and I just knew that he wasn't coming back. So that kind of became my odyssey. That all of the unusual things did not stop when he died. They continued afterwards. And so it was just like, how could this be? I couldn't understand. Mm-hmm. And so I just kept writing to try and understand what had happened. And it took me 15 years to be able to put it together. So that's how the book got written.
Well, I mean, being able to take that long, in, you know, that's totally understandable for how difficult a situation like this is. Now, you talk about at the beginning that, you know, he didn't have an easy birth. There were complications there, but that didn't really have anything to do with what happened in the end.
Right. He did have medical problems when he was born. He was born with a heart condition called transposition of the great arteries. And I had to resuscitate him when he was born. He was delivered, and that in itself was a nightmare. Because everything had been normal up to then, and then we went to the hospital, and Catherine went into labor. And the obstetrician was filling in for the one that was the one that we knew, and we had met him before. Well, it turns out he was insane with schizophrenia, and every time we talked to him, he would say something completely different. And Catherine wanted an epidural, and I'm an anesthesiologist, and that's what I did. I mean, I wrote books about them and gave lectures about them. And I had it all set up that she'd get her epidural. Well, this doctor kept saying that he would give her the epidural, but he never did. He never ordered it. And it took me most of the day to figure out that Dr. X was lying to me. And it turns out he was going insane, and he lost his medical practice like a week or two later. So his mental illness was common knowledge to everybody in the obstetrics floor, but nobody mentioned anything about it to us. So the whole thing was just absolutely a nightmare. And then Brian was born, and my secret fear during the pregnancy was that I would have to resuscitate my own child, because that's basically what we do in anesthesia. We're always resuscitating people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. They delivered... Catherine delivered. Everything looked fine. They put Brian in his little bassinet and turned away, and I was the only one that looked at, you know, that noticed that he stopped breathing. So I resuscitated him, but he stayed blue. So it turns out we discovered that he had a heart problem. And he also had lots of other little minor things, too, like as he had a little bifid thumb on the left that had to be corrected, and he had some problems with his nasal passage on the left. So he required lots of procedures up to the age of 5. But after that, everything seemed to be normal. He was a really, you know, handsome kid.
Mm-hmm.
And he was athletic, and the doctors told us that he should have normal life. And he felt fine. So there was no reason for us to suspect this. It turns out that the kind of heart surgery that Brian had, the risk of sudden death is about the same as a normal kid.
Mm-hmm.
So he did have medical problems when he was born, but still, there was no reason that we knew to think that he might be, you know, having a problem.
Right.
But obviously, he knew.
Which is a very... I mean, when you've done your research, you have discovered that a lot of times, and it's funny, there's a movie that came out called Hereafter that Matt Damon is in, and there's one of the characters in it. She has a near-death experience, and she then tries to do research, and, you know, she has a lot of things happen to her because, you know, these kind of things just aren't in the media and aren't in the normal scientific realm where we can hear some of the things that a lot of people seem to experience.
Well, that was, I mean, there were so many things. I was in shock.
Yeah.
First off, because my child died, and
yeah.
Secondly, because obviously there was all of these things that he knew. One of the things he did before he left to the baseball game, he went to his room, and he wrote some things, and one of which was he put a sign on his door that we saw when we came home, and it said, "Brian's on a trip, don't worry about me."
Hmm.
And another thing he did was that we saw, the very first thing we saw when we came home, after we had gone to the hospital with him, and then, you know, he died there. So we went home, and Brian was very much, he loved Calvin and Hobbes, the comic strip, and he was very much like Calvin. And he did a lot of things. He modeled himself after Calvin sometimes, like we had a babysitter, and Calvin would lock the babysitter in the bathroom. Well, so did Matt. And hide her car keys and, you know, things like that. One thing Calvin did was Calvin had a parrot's bowl. Well, Brian did too. So usually when he was mad at us, he would bring out his parent's bowl and we'd have a low score, like when we told him to clean up his room or something like that. But, you know, occasionally we'd be up. Like, you know, I'd help him with a Cub Scout model car race and he won it. And he gave me a reasonably high score. But usually we were in the middle. Well, we came home, and the first thing he left out for us was our parents' bowl. And for the first time, he gave us a perfect score, perfect 2,000. So he was doing all of these things that morning, you know, to kind of help us out. Well, this was totally beyond my belief system. I didn't know such things were possible. But The media called to find out, because this made the wire service, and made it national radio and things like that, national TV and the newspapers. So we got a lot of reporters that called. Boy, the guy's playing Little League. And I told them that he told us that he was going to die and that he gave himself a going away party. And there were lots of other things he did. But nobody would write about it. They absolutely wouldn't mention that. Just a story about a little boy who died playing Little League. And that really puzzled me. And then one national radio show actually changed the story. What they said was that Brian was dying of, you know, terminal heart disease and wanted to score a run more than anything. So I'm getting a real strong buzz.
Yes.
Are you getting it?
I'm not sure if it's somebody's BlackBerry or I just threw mine away. It seemed to stop. Okay.
Okay. Well, if you can hear, okay, it's fine. What they said was that he struggled up off of his deathbed and went out to the Little League field and, went up to the base and hit the ball and then stumbled around the bases, huffing and puffing, and then collapsed across home plate and died. That was like his last wish, was that he could play baseball. And I thought, why would they change the story? The real story is so much more wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And why would they lie? I mean, it's disrespectful to Brian's life and his story. So anyhow, the long and the short of it was that the media would not tell the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that it was going to come down to me. Now, the problem is that nobody ever had less ability and talent to write than I did. When I was in high school and I had to write poetry, I couldn't do it. I mean, I could write technically as a physician. I was in academics. And I could write a technical article, okay, but anything involving feelings or, abstract thought or anything like that, I just couldn't do it. So here I was left with the fact that nobody would tell this story about my wonderful son. And he had so much to, he died publicly, and he was a little showman. I mean, he was always lighting up crowds, and he was on national TV the week of his birthday and things like that. And it was so obvious to me that Brian's death was supposed to be of meaning to other people, too. I mean, he died out in public, and there were at least 50 of us that knew we were struggling with issues of death before he died. Teachers, ministers, school counselors, stuff like that. So, but the problem was I couldn't write. So I basically just struggled and asked for all the help I could get. And over the years, trying to tell the story, I became a writer.
Hmm.
And people have told me that the book's well written,
mm-hmm.
and it's won several awards. And so that's, that was one of Brian's gifts to me, was that he could write. He wrote beautiful poetry and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then after he died, a lot of the things that he could do, he kind of passed those over to me.
Nice. You also mentioned, now, your second child, Lynn, also had some difficulties, but you have this experience that occurred that night with Lynn.
Right. We had a lot of friends came over and were waiting for us after Brian died. And we got home, and they were taking care of us, which was good because we were really in shock. And then it became obvious that Lynn was 2 years younger than Brian, so she was 7 at the time. And she had cerebral palsy, and mild cerebral palsy and learning disabilities. And so she required lots of extra care. And one thing was she didn't understand that Brian was not coming home again.
Mm.
She didn't understand what death meant. So I tucked her into bed that night, and I curled up with her, and I tried to explain, that Brian wouldn't be coming home, that her brother was up in heaven, and we wouldn't be seeing him anymore until we went to heaven. Now, you have to understand, I was a church-going agnostic. I was an intellectual scientist that didn't believe in any, you know, I didn't believe in anything. As far as I'd been taught, there was never any evidence of paranormal activity. And my wife's a minister, and I like the church community, but I really didn't believe in God. And I just was kind of saying these things because this was the best I could think of to comfort my daughter. And so I said, well, so Brian, you know, Brian's up in heaven. She said, oh, he take airplane? And I said, no, when you die, you leave your body like a butterfly leaves its cocoon. And then you can fly to heaven without an airplane. And she said, oh, I said, Brian, gone, it's dark. And then she looked up at the ceiling, and then her eyes focused. And she was obviously looking at something. And she got this serene smile on her face, and she obviously, I mean, it was so profound. I looked at her, I thought, what can she see? And then I felt a vibration in my back, like the bed was vibrating. And then I could see a luminous river of energy waves carrying us along that I somehow knew had always been there, but I just never could see them before. And I sensed that Brian was part of it. So that was kind of like the kickoff of my spiritual journey. It was one of my first paranormal experiences I had that day. I had one a little bit earlier when after he died, I went to the baseball field. A friend drove me to the baseball field. I didn't want to leave my car there alone overnight for some reason. And I got out of the car, and it was the most beautiful day, and there was another baseball game going on, and there were these picnic shelters with square dances going on. You never saw a more joyful, more beautiful spring day in your life. And I got out of the car, and I wiped a tear from my eye looking at the scene. And the sour smell of Brian's vomit on my hands from when I resuscitated him blended with the honeysuckle and the smell of the barbecue. And all of a sudden, everything got still, and the colors brighter, and the smells got stronger than I had ever seen before. And I just, it was another state of consciousness. And I was at peace, and I knew that everything was as it should be. And that Brian had died a happy boy, he'd finished his work here, and that the only unfinished tasks were mine. So that was kind of like the first paranormal experience I had that day. And then the experience with Lynn later on that night, that was the second.
Yeah, and, you know, clearly the whole book is very well written, and it does explain a lot of different things that happened to you. I mean, I'm thinking that one of the parts of you moving into recovery came from a group called Compassionate Friends.
Right. Now, the Compassionate Friends are a support group for parents that have had the death of a child. And they, at the emergency room after Brian died, you know, they gave us the brochure and told us, you know, that it was a group that we could go visit after we felt a little stronger. And we went there. I went there first, and then Catherine joined me. It took me about a year to be able to go. Let's see, it took me a few months, but it took Catherine about a year. And then it took me another year after that before I could share Brian's story, before I could talk about it. And what was remarkable was that during that whole year that we had been there, or those 2 years, actually, before I told the story, you know, it was a very nice place, and we, it was very useful, helpful being there and supporting each other and sharing stories. But nobody talked about anything paranormal like this.
Right.
And then I told Brian's story. I told about a 5-minute version of it. And then I talked for a few minutes about what happened afterwards. And then the other parents started chiming in with their stories. Now, there were about half the parents had stories that were clearly, there was clear foreknowledge that the child had tried to say goodbye or tried to, you know, was dealing with their own death, even before, like, an accidental death. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, one 12-year-old boy, I mean, this was kind of as amazing as our story. our story was a little more complete from all of the things that Brian did and all the things that happened afterwards. But I read all the literature by this time, and I saw that a lot of the, just about everything that I had experienced had been written about. But there were maybe 12, 16 things that happened that were very unusual with us, that usually other people would only have one or two of them.
Right.
But we had one 12-year-old boy who died in a car accident. And the night before, he wrote a list of his life accomplishments and brought them down for his mom and showed them to his mom. And they talked about, he talked about what he wanted to accomplish in the future. And then there was a 4-year-old girl, and she sounded a lot like Brian, full of life, very artistic. And her mom said, you know, every day she said, you know what, I love you with mad passion. Imagine this from a 4-year-old. And she, this little girl was at daycare and died going down a slide, and a ribbon around her neck caught on the slide and strangled her. Well, this woman brought in the picture for me to see afterward, but she told about it, and then she brought it in later. And Stephanie, half an hour before she died at daycare, had drawn this picture of herself, and it showed her in dark colors hanging from the neck, obviously dead, on one side. And on the other side of the picture was her in bright colors putting on a yellow halo with an angel in the sky dropping more halos down to her. And then this woman said, you know, this little girl always said that she never wanted to grow up and go to school like the other children. And she was just, you know, the joy of my life and the most wonderful little child you can imagine. And so now I also noticed there were some other things, too, in that group. Then a year later, I shared Brian's story at another Compassionate Friends meeting with some other people in it, and the same thing happened again. About half the parents had stories that were clearly, I mean, we all had dreams, and we all had warm feelings, and felt our children were still present in one form or another. But about half of the parents had, like, hard evidence that there was something unusual going on. So really what we call paranormal in that circumstance really is normal, but nobody talks about it. That's one reason I wanted to tell the story, Brian's story, and I created the website, beyondreason.info, so that other parents could share their stories, and that when these things happen, there'll be someplace people could go and see, oh yeah, that's not unusual, that really happens. And also by sharing stories, you kind of get a bigger picture too.
The other thing you mention about the group is that, you know, typically for those who haven't experienced, you know, something like this and had the support, is that we often try and fix and contain grief, which you learn through that, to just allow people to express themselves too, which I think is, you know, a huge problem in our society. We tend to stuff down our emotions instead of allowing, you know, ourselves to truly express what we're going through.
Right. Now, before Brian died, I was, like I have since discovered, a lot of physicians are very afraid of death. And I stayed away from it as much as I could. And I wouldn't have read a book like this. I didn't like going to funerals, didn't like talking about death. But of course, here I'm faced with it, the emptiness that Brian left behind was huge. He was such a huge presence. He was such a force of nature. When he left, the emptiness was huge. And so I spent so much of my time trying to understand what was going on with the grieving process. It was clearly, I mean, the question is, how do you grieve something that clearly was supposed to happen? That was one dilemma I had. And then the other dilemma I had was that everything I read about what, you know, the grieving process was supposed to be, didn't happen. I mean, you know, like the stages of grief,
yes,
that Dr. Kubler-Ross, you know, wrote about, mm-hmm, became famous. You know, I didn't go through any stages of grief. I wasn't in denial. You know, I wasn't angry. I probably had always been depressed, and I was no more depressed, but at least I now had a reason for it. And I wasn't, anger, depression, and bargaining. Who was I supposed to bargain with? I had no desire to bargain. And then, so basically, I had to relearn what did this all mean? And of course, Brian's presence continued. He was like dropping a trail of breadcrumbs through my emptiness, and kind of leading me along the path of healing through dreams and lots of things like that. So his influence was profound. And as a person who went to church, I never really understood how, when people talked about how Brian could die for him, you know, he died for us. And that never made a lot of sense to me. But
no.
What I could see was that it's like playing tennis with someone who's better than you. If a truly, you know, highly spiritual being comes here and you love them and then they die, their abilities are there for the taking. In other words, the things that they could do that you couldn't are there. And if you love them, and if you allow that yourself to learn from them, then their presence kind of integrates into you. So, but the big problem, of course, with people grieving, the ones who really get stuck in it, get isolated. You know, they feel helpless and they're alone, and then they can stay in a pep. I'm on the telephone.
Sorry, that's you.
Let's see. anyhow, the big problem initially when somebody dies is that they don't have a support system.
Yeah.
And even though there's nothing to talk about, I mean, all you can do is just share stories, and it's all emotional. But, you know, the best thing you can do is just kind of cluster around and just be there. But people that don't have that, they can get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the very first thing you need to do. You need to just show up. And church was great for that.
Mm.
So those were the folks that kept coming, kept showing up. Brought the casserole dishes, you know,
yeah.
Kept us going.
Yeah. And you also, you did talk about how, you know, Dr. Kubler-Ross, you know, her grief, but you kind of took it to a different place completely, and talk about The Wizard of Oz, which I think is kind of a unique, yet, you know, very valid profile.
Right. Well, I discovered, you know, and I knew Elizabeth a little bit before she died, before I kind of completed my understanding of what she had been writing about. Now, Elizabeth was a giant. She made a huge contribution. But you have to understand, she was limited by what she saw. And she was a psychiatrist. And she would get, let's say, what happens, my wife was a chaplain in a hospital. And every now and then you get like a woman who has a stillbirth, and she has a baby that was born dead, but she denies it. So she carries it around just like it's still alive, which of course you can imagine drives her a bit crazy on the nursing station. Because this woman is obviously acting crazy, and she's carrying this baby around, and the baby's getting black, and after a few days starting to smell bad. So what do? Well, you send them to a psychiatrist. Same thing if somebody is, you know, has a grief or can't deal with the stress of the situation, becomes very angry, throwing things around, won't take their medicines. So what do? Well, you send them to a psychiatrist. Same thing, they get so depressed, you know, they've been told they have cancer. And they're in the room crying, they won't take their medicines. And, you know, they become withdrawn. So you send them to a psychiatrist. Or somebody becomes very intellectual. No, I looked it up on the internet, I don't have cancer. You know, this and that. I mean, they're inappropriately using their intellect. So she saw these things, and she wrote them as the stages of grief. Well, it turns out that people really don't go from one to the next, but these are kind of roles that we use to cope with stress. And then as I was trying to understand all this stuff, I was exercising, and I watched the DVD of The Wizard of Oz. And it became obvious, oh, of course, one reason that everybody keeps talking about The Wizard of Oz is because it describes something very important that we deal with every day, which is loss and how we cope with it. The reason Dorothy, the dilemma she's in before she gets hit on the head, which stops her rational thinking and allows her to go to the land of Oz, she's in this dilemma. She's an orphan living with a family doesn't have time for her. Her only love comes from her dog, and her dog is threatened with death. So either she runs away and loses what little family she has, or she stays and loses her dog. I mean, there's no rational way out for her.
Mm-hmm.
She's dealing with loss. You know, the profound loss of what little love she has in her life. And then she goes there. Well, I realized that what Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was describing was basically the characters in The Wizard of Oz. You've got the witch, which is anger, and you've got the cowardly lion, which is depression, and then you've got the scarecrow, which is brains, you know, bargaining, without heart, but she leaves out the scarecrow. And you know why she leaves out the scarecrow? And that's emotions, heart without brains. Because when a scarecrow you take the role of scarecrow, you're very emotional. And you take that to the emotional, dysfunctional extreme, you become anxious and panicky. Well, that's the one thing you can deal with as a physician on the ward. You can give tranquilizers. So they don't get referred to the psychiatrist as much. You can handle that at least enough to get them out the door. Okay? So she didn't get the scarecrow. So that's the one she left out. But those are the roles that we use when we're trying to deal with a stressful situation. One of my hobbies is working with groups of people in outdoor challenge courses, ropes courses, outward bound sort of thing. And I've been doing that for like over 30 years. And one thing I noticed is you give a group a challenge like, okay, everybody has to get up over the wall, and you give them a story. To frame it with an interesting story, like on the other side of the walls, these are business students, for instance, from the business school. And, of course, they're interested in getting their first job. So you say, on the other side of this wall is your first job with a great salary and a new car and a nice office and everything. The entire group has to get over the wall and then you can get the job. So every challenge starts with something is missing. The group is missing something. And then if the challenge is boring, if there's not enough of a challenge, let's say you make the wall 2 feet high, everybody can walk over it, they're bored. Okay. And if you make it 20 feet high and they can't get over it, then they get frustrated, they go to extremes, and you see the extremes, of Kubler-Ross, except you see the scarecrow with anxiety and panic. But if the challenge is a little bit challenging, then the group will split up. And they split up into the different roles. And these are functional, not dysfunctional. In other words, somebody will take charge. They'll be like at a football game. You got the coach, he's the brains. Then you got the cheerleaders and the band and the dancers. And they provide the spirit, the heart. And then you got the players that go out there and they deal with external conflict. And they go out and bump up against the other team. Okay, so then that would be like, the witch, external conflict. And then you have the trainers and the managers that deal with the internal problems, the sprained ankles or the dirty clothes and stuff like that. So a group will naturally split up into these characters like the Wizard of Oz. They'll split up, and then they'll be functional, and then they'll accomplish their task, and then they come back together again. So I got to see through these different threads that my life has taken me on that grieving is just another stress. Everything we do starts with the fact we're missing something, every challenge. I mean, if it's a fun challenge, we want to go play tennis, well, we haven't played, we haven't had the challenge, we haven't beaten the opponent. Something's missing, okay, and that's fun. And if it gets to be where something's really missing and it's a huge part of our heart is missing, we've lost our loved one, then that's grief. And that becomes very difficult to deal with. So everything we do, everything that creates action in our life starts with the fact that something is missing. And Kubler-Ross was talking about the dysfunctional aspects of it, but she missed a little part of it. But The Wizard of Oz really talks about it, very completely.
It's fascinating. You also talk about dreams and how there are really three types of dreams, and you experience them in different ways. But talk about those.
Sure. Well, one thing we shared about compassionate friends was it's very common to have dreams about our children and that have died. And after a while, listening to the stories and comparing them with the ones that my wife and I had, I began to realize that they were very similar, that they fall into three different categories. And the first are the ones that happen right away, and those are the pain dreams, where you relive the trauma. And what mine was that I relived in my dreams the resuscitation scene. He died, and I, you know, went to resuscitate him, and I called for help, and but nobody would help me. And during the resuscitation, I shut down the true resuscitation. I shut down all my emotions, and I acted like a medical robot. I mean, here's my child. In order to be able to do what I know should be done, I really can't feel anything. And then, but in the dreams, I felt everything, and they were extremely painful. And I would cry out for help, and it wouldn't come. And, you know, and that would happen. That went on for the first week. Every night I'd go to sleep, and I'd relive the trauma. And I call those the pain dreams. And what they do is they keep us in touch with our pain. Now, why would your body want to do that? Well, I discovered, as I went through my own healing process, that the most important things, the thoughts weren't important, the different thought forms and everything. The important things that you need to heal, little things and big things, you need to feel pain, and you need to feel you know, the pain of whatever it is that needs to heal. Pain reveals, and then you need to feel love. Love is what heals. So pain reveals and love heals. Mm. So these dreams keep us in touch with our pain. In order to heal, to move on with your life and become more than you were before, you need to feel the pain of what you were missing. Okay? And you have to trust that the process is there for you to, you know, to get it. It won't be in the form you think it will be, but if you allow yourself to feel the pain and you allow yourself to accept the love that's, you know, that's around you, the healing process will continue. So that was the first, and you'd hear that from other parents a lot too. And then, usually a couple months later, you start getting the other kind of dream. Well, this was like our experience of that was, it was like he died in the springtime. And when you have the loss of a loved one, family events are kind of tough, you know, like Christmas, birthdays, things like that. So we had our first Christmas without Brian, and we weren't looking forward to it because that's such a family time, you know, you were so aware of the loss. So we decided, we accepted my in-laws' offer to stay with them at a hotel in Hershey, Pennsylvania. So we went up there and got there a couple, Christmas Eve or the day before, and unpacked, and it was kind of sad. And we were all kind of, went out for dinner, and then we came back, went to bed. And then the next morning, we found out that everybody, all the women, Catherine, my wife, Lynn, Brian's sister, and the grandmother, Jackie, they'd all dreamed of Brian, and they all woke up after the dream was over. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, so they were all in different rooms. And they all said that Brian had come to them. He looked a little bit older. He said he was fine and not to worry about him. Okay, and it turns out that's very common. That's the I'm okay dream. And what you get is you have the loved one who usually looks like they're older. They're continuing to grow, and they don't need us, and the loss is much worse for us than it is for them. And so that's, you know, that's kind of, they're reassuring us. And then the last dream is variable. Not everybody gets it, but it usually takes a couple of years before you experience that. And those are the goodbye dreams. And mine was, and it's very common to hear the same sort of story. I'm driving around in my car in my dream, and then I see Brian alongside the road. So I get in, and now he's a young man with a beard. And he gets into the car, and I'm so glad to see him, and we're visiting and driving along. And then he says it's time for him to get out, to pull over, and he has to go his own separate way. And so do I. And so he gets out, says goodbye, and then you drive off. Well, in my dream, a little different was that I drove to where I was going, and then I came back. I decided I want to go see him some more. So I drove back to where I dropped him off and called for him. And so he showed up dutifully and got into the back seat of my car, and I was so glad to see him and visiting. But he started to change, to grow, you know, expand, and lose his human form. And I realized he was being cramped by my small car, which is the image of my life, my life's journey. And I apologized for holding him back and thanked him for coming back and told him he was okay for him to go. So then he left, and the feeling of love for him remained, but he was gone. So that's the third dream, which is the goodbye dream. It's time for us to go our separate ways, you know. We all have our own lives, and it's time for us to move on from the loss.
Yeah. The other thing that you discuss a lot in the book is your experience with the Monroe Institute, and I've done a few interviews with people that have been part of it, and it's just I find it fascinating. I find it fascinating that, you know, the Monroe Institute keeps coming up. I'm sure there's something there for me. But talk about that, because that was kind of instrumental in allowing your healing and understanding of the paranormal experiences that you've been having.
Mm-hmm. Right. I live in Charlottesville, which I came here because I was teaching at the University of Virginia. And I didn't realize that Charlottesville, it turns out, is like on the leading edge of consciousness for the world. The first books about out-of-body experiences were written by Robert Monroe, who founded the Monroe Institute. The first books in the entire world's literature about life after death was written by Raymond Moody and Dr. Ritchie, and they were from here. And then the very first books about documenting the instances of reincarnation and remembered lives by children was Ian Stevenson. That was here in Charlottesville. Plus, there's a lot more stuff, too. So this stuff was all here, and I didn't know about it. And then as I was trying to understand what had happened, a series of coincidences took me on a road to by the Monroe Institute to visit a friend of mine. So I was interested. It kept coming up, the Monroe Institute, all of a sudden, like, you know, a couple times in the same week, or talking about Bob Monroe. So I called up Bob Monroe to talk to him, and I just I got a couple of his books, and he was talking about out-of-body experiences and other states of consciousness and everything like that, dealing with realms after death and things like that. So I went to have lunch with him, and he was actually bored by Brian's story. I started telling him about pouring my soul out, spilling my guts. And he's going, oh, okay, that was a pre-death cognition, okay. He had some other things he wanted to talk about. He was working on a series of, he came up with these sound technologies that help people have experience different states of consciousness, out-of-body experiences. And he was using those, came up with a program for helping people through surgery, and needed anesthesiologists to help out. And he wanted to design some studies, which is what I was doing at the time at the university. So we talked about that, and then I started, I ended up going to the Monroe Institute. They have week-long workshops. You go and you listen to these tapes and go on guided meditation and with a group. And so I went once a year for a week, for about 12 years. Hmm. And I had the most profound experiences. It was amazing. And I talked about some of them in the book. One was the first week I was there at the end. And I was feeling my loss from Brian very, very greatly. And I had been told that you could create a dream. You know, when you go into guided meditation, it's really very similar to a dream state. And I had found out I had a talent for that. I got to a very deep, profound level of dream, you know, the dream world, where it's not just you. I mean, you're in a world that's more intelligent than you are. Mm-hmm. And I was told that you could create a dream and invite somebody into it. So in my last meditation for the last full day, I created this garden, a dream garden, and I invited Brian into it. And so I poured all the love that I hadn't expressed for him. You know, what I discovered after he died, one thing I discovered, was that when you lose a child, a lot of times you, and they're gone, you realize you love them even more than you thought you did. I mean, all the little irritations, they are not brushing their teeth, they're not picking their clothes up, you know, things like that. Those go away, and those are distractions. And then when you're done, you're left with this person I love as myself, you know, and it's so profound, and it goes to the very roots of your being, where you two separate things that really are not separate. So I had never expressed all the love I truly felt for him, and so I created this little patio with this little border of stones, and I poured the love that I had never expressed to him into it. Mm-hmm. And then Brian took form, this cloud appeared and then condensed into the shape of Brian. And so I ran up to him and hugged him, and I was so glad to see him, but he started turning into a stone statue, and I could tell that there was no emotion there. And then the light that had been within his body turned into a little orb and zipped away, you know, faster than anything I'd ever seen before, and disappeared. And I realized that by the act of my will, wanting to recreate the past and bring him back was not going to work, and that I couldn't do this by my will alone. And so I lost all desire to control things and floated up out of the garden into this black void. And I looked up, and there was a very a stone vortex circulating, very huge vortex. And that looked like a good place to rest. So I floated up and settled in there. And then I felt his presence next to me. And I looked down, and it was this chipmunk, which is Brian's favorite animal. Hmm. And he crawled in my lap and looked in my eyes, and everything went white. And I just was, like, blown away with this all unconditional love. I mean, we talk about unconditional love, but I had never felt anything like that before. It was like I was being reprogrammed. And it was like the most beautiful experience. I don't even mention that in the book. It's too much to talk about. And then after that, I returned to normal consciousness. And I was aware of the fact that Brian could not come through the past. He could only come through my openness in the present. And then after that, these paranormal things started happening to me. You know, mm-hmm. Things that Brian could do started happening to me.
Yeah, which I guess is exciting and yet a little, I mean, I too like that you said, you know, you may have started to experience paranormal, but it didn't really change the fact that you still had things to heal, and it didn't really change your life in any way. It just allowed you maybe a deeper awareness, a deeper understanding.
Right. All these things started happening, and it really was more of a reminder that these things are possible. It is possible to see the future. And but the biggest difference is the empathy. I mean, if I'm in a house with somebody and they, you know, they're not sleeping well, I don't sleep well. I mean, if we go visit somebody and they have to get up to the bathroom 5 times a night, I do. It's like, it's really not, you know, it's not such a wonderful thing to feel this kind of empathy. But that's kind of what it is. But things as far as useful, they're not at all useful. It's like, it's just enough for me to know. It never gives me an advantage over somebody else. I'll never learn. I'll never see the lottery number or anything like that. It's always things to help me on my, to become more open, more aware. It's, you know, it's very interesting how that worked out. But I had, and of course, synchronicities, that happens more often now too. That's continued to go on. One of the synchronicities was that when I was driving up by the Monroe Institute, that first day I was going to visit a friend of mine, Scott, who was a bike mechanic. And it turns out his father-in-law, Joseph Chilton Pierce, was a friend of Bob Monroe. The reason Bob Monroe, he was a mentor to Bob Monroe. One reason that Bob came to set up his institute there was because that's where Joe Pierce was. And Joe had written the book, Magical Child. And Joe travels all around the world and gives lectures about, you know, know, the mystical, wonderful abilities of children and how they can be exploited and used by society and how they can be stopped, which is what we do in our society. We really shut that down very much. And so if there's any one person in the entire world that can help me understand a magical child like Brian, it was Joe Pierce. And he showed up right in my backyard. And he became my mentor. And over many years, I would come and listen, and he'd tell me this most wonderful story about his own experiences and his travels all around the world and his research. I mean, the man's a genius. Mm-hmm. So I got to appreciate that. Children are a natural connection with this great intelligence of the universe. And I talk about it in the book a few times. When we had another son, Matthew, and when he was, I think he was about four, I was doing an IQ test that I found in a magazine, and there was one question I couldn't figure out, and it was the hardest one. He needed an IQ over 150, which is like way beyond 100 million. And Matt was walking by, and I said, Matt, look at this. Can you tell me what the answer is? And he glanced over and said, B, which was the correct answer. I said, how did you know that? He said, I don't know. And then I think it was a couple days later, I was asked him to go weigh himself because I was filling out a application for preschool for him. And he came back and he said it was a 3 and a 0. So he weighed 30 pounds. He couldn't count to 30 yet. So that's good. I said, okay, 30. I wrote it down on the thing. We filled out the thing together. And then a couple hours later, I was filling out an insurance physical for myself. And Matt came by and looked over my shoulder. And I wrote down my weight as 180. He goes, oh, 6 Matthews. And it was a couple years after that before he knew multiplication and division.
Of course.
So I have been aware since then. And there are other things I talk about in the book, too, a couple of examples. But I'm very aware of the fact that children naturally have this. We all naturally have this. And we give it up. And we also, just like people wouldn't accept, tell Brian's story, the media wouldn't, we won't, our society will not allow children to express this kind of giftedness. It's just not allowed.
Yeah. Well, hopefully that is changing. Hopefully that, you know, as these kids, and, you know, they seem to be getting brighter and brighter, at least in their consciousness and their light over the last few years. So it's like they're all changing. And it certainly hopes that that gives us hope that, it, you know, our world is also changing. One of the last things I will leave this with, and then we're actually going to listen to a song that was written for Billy, and the musician is Trent Wagler.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, one of the things that you mentioned, and I think it's, you know, probably the place that we will leave it, but, you know, the shock goes away, but the love will always stay.
Right. And the love is transformative. You lose this person in reality, in physical reality, and they go away, but something doesn't go away. And this love is the most creative place. And if you allow yourself just to hold it and be in it and just to trust it, the most amazing things can come out of it. And you can come out of it as a different person, more whole, more complete. More understanding, more compassionate. You may have increased abilities. So grief, emptiness is a pathway. And when it's really big, we call it grief.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it is the strongest pathway. So I don't mean to belittle the loss people go through, but I can only say the more powerful the loss, the more powerful the transformation is possible.
That's true. And, you know, I think this is a beautiful little book. It's extraordinarily touching. It certainly talks about, you know, all the important things, as well as allowing people to see that there's just, you know, there's a higher force in this universe that is available to us, and that can help us. It can help us, maybe not through the grief, but to get to the other side, to allow the love. It allows us to, you know, to expand who we are so that we can open ourselves up to allow that healing and that love to come through. One of the things you said also is that, you know, to heal, you need to feel two things, which is the pure love, but also the pure pain.
Right. The pain is lets you know that there's something missing.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's what it is that you are, that you will heal, that you will find.
Yeah. Well, this has been a great pleasure, and I really did enjoy the book. I've enjoyed the interview. What is next for you?
Oh, what is next?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm trying to let people find the website so that people
yes.
can find, have a healing community that anybody around the world can get to when they have the loss of a loved one, a child, and,
yes.
and their things, especially if they're paranormal things they don't understand. So that's beyondreason.info. And anybody's welcome to go there, and the first chapter, which is Brian's story, is there, so you can read that. And then I've got, I'm really busy. I've still got, kids that are take up a lot of time and everything. But I have another book that really wants to be written also.
Nice.
And I think we'll continue a lot of these ideas that I wrote in the first one.
Nice. Well, when that's ready, I would love to interview you again.
Oh, that'd be great. I'd like it.
All right. Well, we are going to end it now, and I'm going to play the song. But thank you very much for joining me.
Enjoy talking to you.
Me too.
Billy Corbin was a boy, knew he was to die. So he packed a bag to go away. No one knew why. No one knew why. Mama said, "Don't go, son, you will make me cry." Billy said, "I love you, man. I've got to fly. I've got to fly." Kinfolk, letters far and near. Billy knew that very soon he would not be here. He would not be here. Mom and Dad thought Billy might have lost his mind, so they took him to a doctor, and the doctor said he's fine. Oh, this boy is fine. Don't worry about me. His last day was glorious. The birds all sang in peace. Well, he laughed and ran and won the game, and then his heart just ceased. Oh, his heart just ceased. Billy Corbin was a boy who knew he was to die. So he packed a bag.